The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Be sure to check out our Minnesota Timberwolves podcast, Wolves Wired, on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Join our Wolves insider, Zach Bennett, as well as Tim Fakeless from the Sporting News and the Wolf Among Wolves, and I, as we offer our insights from inside the Minnesota Timberwolves locker room. For many great offerings on the Minnesota Timberwolves and other local sports teams, be sure to follow us on Twitter at ColdOmahaMN, like the Cold Omaha Facebook page, and visit ColdOmaha.com.
Thanks again for joining us on Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. This is episode number 8. You're listening to us on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network at Cold Omaha MN on Twitter. I am joined, as always, by my producer and maestro, Andy Carlson, at Andy Carlson Show. Andy, how you doing?
What's up? How you doing?
What's the story with you and this vegan business? Are you going vegan for a while? Is it just an experiment, I think you did something like that for a week, but are you done with it now?
Well, it started off as a drunken bar wager.
We've all been there.
Did it for a week, did some more research, and you know how the standard is. Watch a few documentaries and all that other good stuff. Mm-hmm. But just kind of noticed that like energy levels went up, lost a little bit of weight, and just felt healthier. So just kind of running with it for now. It's not the whole ethical, we shouldn't eat animals. I don't have that stance.
Sure.
Mine's just more selfish. Hey, I feel great doing this, so I'm just going to keep doing this. I don't know if it's going to be a lifetime-changing thing, but for now, short-term, it's pretty damn awesome.
And now, have you been losing weight for kind of a long period of time here? Because you look good, I have to say.
Yeah, how you doing? I think I peaked at like 230, but now down to like 205. And it's probably not all eating meat, but the whole processed stuff, and you know how the whole Western diet goes.
Yeah. Well, speaking of losing weight, we'll bring in somebody who has no need to lose weight. You've seen him on flagship MLB programming, including MLB Now in the last week or so. You've seen him in the front row of the Arizona Fall League Fall Stars game. You've seen him on Baseball Prospectus, FanGraphs, even on Snapchat, and maybe even rocking a hoodie in 80-degree weather. It's Paul Sporer. Paul, how are we doing?
It wasn't 80 degrees.
No, but I can see that you would maybe do that. I think you told me.
The cutoff is about 65, 70. I mean, which is still pretty ridiculous. I understand to most people that sounds insane. But, yeah, about 65 degrees, I would still have a hoodie on. 70, I'd be close. You start getting into 75, then I'm actually okay. Might just have a long sleeve shirt on at that point. And then in 80, we'll go full short sleeves.
Well, and in your defense, you live in Texas, and also in your defense, it was in Arizona where the temperature is a dry heat, so 65 there is going to be different than 65 in Michigan or Minnesota. But I guess the origin of me kind of kidding you was when you bought that Colorado Rockies hoodie. We were in Arizona, actually, so the difference here with Paul as a guest, other than some of the other guests we've had recently, is that Paul and I have actually met in person at the FanGraphs house in Scottsdale last year. So, first of all, it's kind of cool to have somebody on that I've actually met in person.
Right. Isn't it interesting when you ask guests that you're like, I actually know this person in real life. It's such a rarity these days on the internet. But yeah, it is fun that we met. Had a great time at the trip last year. We pushed the trip to the summer this year, so that's going to be very interesting. Are you going to be able to make it to New York?
I haven't even really thought about it yet. My summers are pretty wide open compared to the spring. We got March Madness at work as far as coverage in college basketball. But that's what was complicating my trip last time, if you remember. You guys all went to Chibo and got pizza, which Keith Law, I believe, calls the second best pizza place in the Scottsdale, Phoenix area. Meanwhile, I got to stay home and eat, leftover croissants and watch like wildlife run through the backyard and kind of creep me out as it got dark. So it was a little bit weird to be in this sprawling house with like, I don't know how many beds, with like 13 beds in the house. And I'm the only one there in a neighborhood that I literally have no idea where anything is. So
it was the FanGraphs compound.
Exactly. But it was cool. You know, we had a pool, we had a place for everybody to play board games and hang out. And you know, a great time was had by, I think, pretty much everyone.
I would have to agree. It was a great time. I'm looking forward to the summer trip, but that spring training trip, it was fantastic. Had a real blast. Still have that Colorado Rockies hoodie. The zipper broke, which is pretty annoying because of how expensive it was to have the zipper break that quickly. But I've heard I can get that fixed somewhere, but I'm too lazy to do
that.
Well,
there's some. I think there's some Troy Tulowitzki symbolism at play there.
That's pretty funny.
One of my highlights of the trip last year, you and I, well, we actually, I think we started hanging out kind of at the first game we went to, which was that Talking Stick. And it was, let's see, the Diamondbacks playing the A's, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And so we checked out the Rockies team store in the right field corner, swung all the way over to the left field corner, checked out the Diamondbacks team store. And then do you remember what happened after that when we were walking?
You're damn right,
back?
I do.
Yeah. So we're walking back to our seats, and none other than Randy Johnson walks about 2 feet away from us. And I think I was too dumbstruck to talk. I don't know if you had the same feeling.
We played it. I was trying to play it cool, like, oh, there's Randy Johnson. Let's not freak out. Let's just point him out and then keep moving. I wish I would have said something to him, though. He seems like the kind of guy who would be totally cool with like a quick selfie or something. I'm in on the selfie over the autograph now. I'm totally cool with that. We probably could have done something like that. We weren't expecting it. We weren't thinking on our feet. So we just took the experience and said, you know what? We just saw Randy Johnson. We'll tell the guys and we'll just kind of move on from there.
Yeah, I prefer the experiential stuff rather than the autographs. I mean, I have some autographs. That's more from when I was younger. But the experiential stuff, like, yeah, I was in the same area as Randy Johnson. Yeah, that's kind of cool. Speaking of left-handed pitchers, by the way, one of the highlights was my team. And I don't remember if you were on my team or not, but winning the wiffle ball game on a walk-off. And it was what was funny was I hit a single. I just rolled it through the infield against Jeff Sullivan. And so basically what the other team had decided was they needed to employ a loogie against me. And the third time that I faced him, I finally solved him. But I had a whole heap of fun playing that game, I have to be honest.
It was great. I had to leave early because we were covering something. I don't know if it was the what game or no, it was the draft.
It was labor. It was a labor draft? Yeah.
I was going to labor with Eno. So I had to leave early. Didn't get to see the finish of it, but I was technically on the winning team then because you and I were on the same team. That was a blast, too. We played wiffle ball. I mean, amazing weather, baseball, playing wiffle ball. That trip was a dream. It was really, really awesome.
And then got to meet Eric Longenhagen, now of ESPN Insider, one of Keith Law's, I think, right-hand men doing prospect stuff. And he was a Fangraphs guy back beforehand. So lots of cool people to meet, lots of fun was had. And so do you have to go back to Arizona for that draft this year?
I don't. I was actually just running the board and helping Eno. I'm in Labor Mixed, which is an online draft that already happened. So I will not be going back to Arizona at all this spring. I'm actually going to be going to New York for Tout Wars, though, so I'm pretty geeked about that.
That's pretty big. So Labor Mixed was what you were on Snapchat talking about about a week ago, right?
Yes. So, Peace Boar, by the way, if you want to follow me on Snapchat. I had a blast. Like, I don't know. It just kind of hit me like, why don't you do some Snapchat stuff? I've kind of been on Snapchat for a long time, really passively, but I think it's pretty good. You know, I know the association that a lot of people have with it. I'll tell you, that's not what it is anymore. I know it kind of started as being the for illicit pictures, but it's really grown from that. I think they've done a great job kind of outrunning that. I know some people have that impression of it still as like the home for dick pics, but it's not that. First off, I haven't gotten any. I haven't sent any, so we're good on that front. But no, it's just a lot different now. I just think that they've figured out a way to grow. You know, the stuff that they do with events, you know, big games. Fashion Week is happening on there. Not something that necessarily appeals to me, but they have like everything. There's some lantern thing in Taiwan that they celebrate every year. Whatever's happening around the world, Snapchat has cool stuff. So anyway, I just think it's a cool social medium that I'm kind of on and doing more of this year, and it was a great time to do it with the draft. I'm going to be doing it in Tout Wars. My noob ass is going to New York. I've never really been to New York. I went to a Mets game, and I've been to – this might not even be in New York – Penn Station. I think that's a place there. Anyway, very noob New York. I've spent hours there basically. So I'll have my first weekend there. I'll be Snapchatting the crap out of it, doing the Tout Wars head-to-head draft, which is going to be really cool. I don't have a whole lot of head-to-head experience, so that's going to be fun. So yeah, Snapchat. I think it's a cool social media. I mean, if you've kind of avoided it because of what you think it is, I would definitely tell you to change your mind on that piece.
Well, it's cool that it's shaken the stigma. I just turned 30 over the weekend, and so for me, I just feel old on there because I can't figure it out. I dabble in it. My wife has it figured out, and she's just a couple weeks older than I am. But it's those kind of things that do make me feel a little bit on the old side. Now, as far as New York City, I went in 2006, and I think I got the full experience, got to see a Mets and Giants doubleheader because it had gotten weathered out the day before. In fact, that was what delayed our flight and had us fly into Newark instead of, I believe it would have been LaGuardia. Anyway, so I got to see Barry Bonds play. I got to see a young Jose Reyes hit a triple, and that's when I fell in love with him as a player. A little less so now based on some of the things he's been up to. However, I also managed to go to a Yankees game, and it was the game where Melky robbed a home run from Manny Ramirez, which was kind of an iconic play of the 2006 season. You know, anytime you can see the Red Sox and the White Sox, or the Yankees, excuse me, play a game is big. And then got to go check out the monster seats and go to Fenway. Jeez. all on the same trip. We drove up or drove over, I don't know what the directions are, to Boston and back. Stayed in Boston.
That's a monster trip. That's fantastic.
I was 20, you know, so you don't fully appreciate it when you're 20, already 10 years ago. So hopefully we can go back again. But I'll be living vicariously through you for that Tout Wars trip. How soon is that?
That will be maybe in about a month, just under a month, actually. It's the weekend of the 18th through the 20th. So I'm really, really psyched about that. Admittedly kind of nervous about traveling to New York. I know that sounds so noob. And I told Colette that too. He's the travel wizard. So the travel wizard will be there taking care of me. I'll be all right. It's just going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think New York City is a whole lot of fun. And obviously I don't think I'd like to live there, but to visit is sure fun. Here's a question. You talked about having the labor mixed draft just now. You talked about Tout Wars in about a month. Which setup do you prefer when it comes to drafting, super early or super late? Do you have a situation that you prefer?
I mean, I kind of like the early draft. It's really interesting. I don't really like getting too hooked on average draft positions in the first place. You know, it's kind of a natural thing to do, but I really try not to get locked in. And when you do a mid-February draft, it's not really locked in, and a lot of people are kind of going their own way. So I think it's really interesting. I mean, by the time I go to Tout Wars, Colette and I will look back at our team and we'll probably be like, oh, that's interesting. We kind of forgot that we did this, that, and the other, because it is such an early draft. Obviously, the closest that you can draft to opening day is generally better in terms of having a more complete sheet because there have been moves, there have been injuries, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of like maybe getting, you know, more of your quote unquote sleepers or things of that nature, doing it earlier like that, I think, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's kind of a set it and forget it kind of aspect to it. I had our first, or my only actually, auto new draft over the weekend. And I'm in Fangraphs 2. I think Fangraphs 1 drafted at Arizona last year, if I remember correctly. I was sitting kind of checking that out. And I have to be honest, my team is pretty stacked. I've got Bogarts, Machado, and Carlos Correa up the middle, and Bryce Harper. So kind of kind of lucked out with the prospects. But I like early drafts for certain reasons. I like late ones for certain reasons. I think the early ones can kind of set aside who's done their research and who's going to stick to their guns a little bit more. I'm a guy who has players he likes and has players he doesn't like. And so when there's a draft board, you know, as the draft goes on, I'm the guy scrolling all the way down to find a name that I've been, you know, stuck on for quite a while. I did the number fire mock, and that's how I wound up with a guy that's rocketing up a lot of lists, Raisel Iglesias, who I think, are you on the hype train for him?
Yeah, and I'm going to be a Raisel hipster and say I was on that hype train pretty early back in you know, October, November, and it's kind of gotten off the tracks a little bit. He's unfortunately not somebody I'm just going to be able to get as much going into the season because the price has gotten, too high. I'm not going to be out totally because it is a guy I believe in. So even at the higher cost, I'll buy a share or two at this point, and I play a lot of leagues. But, you know, coming into the winter, I thought this was going to be a guy that I'd get on, you know, eight or nine of my teams, and now I'm thinking, okay, maybe a couple. I've got a couple keeper leagues where I'll be able to get Raisel Iglesias cheap. He's really good, but, you know, we don't know what kind of workload he's going to give. It's not like he was great all of last year. The stuff is there, but it's not – I just don't know that we've seen enough to overvalue him, and I think right now he might be getting a little bit overvalued. So, unfortunately, I've had to cool my jets a little bit on Raisel Iglesias, but I still love him. I'm still really excited for his season.
Yeah, he's got the strikeouts and grounders that I think everybody loves, and, you know, just kind of a foundational thing for when you're trying to find sleepers. We'll back up here just a little bit. You can be found on Twitter at Sporer. Is that accurate?
It is.
Okay, you can find us at Cold Omaha MN. Subscribe on iTunes. Look for Midwest Swing. I believe we are the only podcast named that. In fact, the other day I Googled Midwest Swing iTunes, and our podcast came up before the song, which is kind of amazing.
Was pretty good, though.
Yeah, so we're in the cachet higher in terms of keywords or something in Google. So that's
good.
Cool. Yeah,
that's good. If you pass the song, I mean, it's a good song. And if you pass the song, that means you're doing some good things. So congrats. That's awesome.
Well, yeah, let's hope so. So you live in Texas, but where did you grow up?
I grew up just outside of Detroit for 14 years and then moved to deep South Texas.
So you moved with your parents and you moved with your family?
Yeah, essentially went from Canada to Mexico, given the proximity of where the two cities that I lived in were. It was a pretty interesting move.
So you were rooted in Tigers fandom by 14, though, to the point where nothing was going to sway you?
Oh, yeah. I didn't jump off of any of the Detroit teams, really.
Well,
the only allegiance that I switched, you know, I grew up a Michigan football fan and really all their sports. Mm-hmm. But once I got my own alma mater, the University of Texas, that's where I've really switched. I still, you know, would like to see Michigan do well or whatever, but I don't really care.
Did you give any thought to going back to Michigan for school, or was it always Texas for you?
It was so expensive, and so especially so for a out of stater. Mm-hmm. That no, I didn't really give it that much thought. Plus, that way I don't have to deal with the painful thought of the fact that I probably wouldn't have gotten in anyway. I can just blame it on money this way and be like, I couldn't afford it, but I definitely would have gotten in. It's Michigan, pretty easy. let's be honest, I probably wouldn't have gotten in anyway, but the fact that, you know, I would have then been an out-of-state person trying to go there, no way, just way too much. Texas, in-state, is relatively affordable on the scale of college, and that was still super expensive. So I couldn't even fathom the idea of going to something like somewhere like Michigan on an out-of-state fee.
Yeah, and I'm still paying student loans probably for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Forever.
What did you study in school, and I didn't either. Do you any work outside of baseball stuff?
No, baseball is my life's work now. Nice. I studied history and government. I like to read and write. So, you know, everyone's like, not directly using my major, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people aren't. I get it, sure. But, you know, I read and wrote a buttload with that major and minor. And so what do I do now? I read and write a buttload. So yeah, I am still kind of using it. I was training to become a full-time reader and writer. So I'm completely fine with everything. I'm glad I went, but yeah, the cost is pretty obscene. And from what I hear, it's actually getting worse. Not that we need to get off on a tangent about, college education in this country, but it's pretty bad.
So how did you get into baseball? When was your beginning, you know, when you first started watching and you're like, yeah, gee, I really like this?
You know, I grew up just being a diehard sports fan. I really got that from my dad. He was, you know, total sports, and I fell right into it right away. I don't think it was forced on me, but if it was, I'm fine with it because, like I said, I don't ever remember a time where I pushed back and, you know, he was like, no, you have to like it. I just instantly loved it, and sports have been a central part of my life forever. Played, you know, T-ball right away, into baseball, only played baseball a little bit early high school, not good enough, couldn't hit. The story for most people, I'm sure. but, you know, love football, basketball, liked hockey, you know, grew up in Hockey Town, for crying out loud, so I totally understand the greatness of hockey. I don't follow it as much anymore living in Texas and being such a baseball diehard. Really started to gravitate toward baseball as I got a little bit older. And, you know, once I kind of got into college, I was baseball, football, and, you know, really tried to focus on both of them. Really wanted to be almost like a dual writer, like the Deion Sanders of writing.
There you go.
But then realized, you know, probably focus a little bit more. In fact, I got advice from Rick Wilton, a big injury guy in the fantasy game. Somebody who works for Baseball HQ, and we were writing for this one website, you know, small website, long time ago. This conference call that we were going to be on, and he and I were the first two on, and I was total noob. And we, you know, we were just kind of talking about things, and he said, maybe find something, find an expertise, find something you want to study and maybe kind of get good at that, as opposed to trying to be the jack of all trades. And, you know, maybe some people would disagree with that, but I took that to heart. And that's when I kind of started to focus not only on baseball specifically, but also pitching in baseball. You know, he had his injury thing. That's what really sprung him and became his thing. I was like, okay, well, I'll just focus on specifically pitching. And so I narrowed my focus, but really, really dove in. And that's kind of been what I've been doing since. I went to college, finished that, worked at Dell. And that was great for 6 years, but I didn't want to do it forever. Ended up getting laid off, took the severance. Tried baseball, it didn't work. Jumped back into the you know, IT tech world, whatever. I worked for a company called Tableau. It was great. They're a great company, but they were pretty certain that I wasn't that interested. I think it was clear that my mind was in baseball, and I didn't give my best effort there, and so they fired me, and I totally understand that. and then I gave baseball a second full-time try, and it stuck. So that's kind of how I got to here.
Well, as a Minnesota guy, I'll let the Hockey Town thing slide for Detroit. I don't want to get into that.
I don't know what you – what do we mean slide? It's the truth. Sorry, we're so awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
You could be Hockey State.
Okay, fine. I'll take that. So what – you know, you started watching this kid. What's the first, like, Tigers team that you really remember where you're like, that's my team? You know, was it, like, in the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, keep in mind – you know, I was 3 when they won the World Series in 84, so I don't remember that. Mm-hmm. I have very vague memories of 87 with them being good, you know, just kind of having a knowledge. Okay, they're good, but honestly, most of my memories are of them being terrible, you know, just being a really, really bad team. And if it wasn't for fantasy, maybe it wouldn't have taken as much hold because my parents, my dad at his work, they started a fantasy league in 89.
Wow.
You know, obviously a total by hand fantasy league. It was an American league only. Obviously we were an American league town, 10 teams. My mom was also in it.
Wow.
Big baseball fan, 3-time champion, by the way, hasn't won in a while. Her heyday has passed her by, but she was a total stud, for quite a while there. So, you know, I follow both of their teams, really interested in the draft. That was really my connection to baseball as a kid. I love the Tigers. I definitely – they were my team through and through. But it's, you know, hard to kind of get locked in on a 53-109 team or a, you know, 69-92 team. And there were just tons of those throughout my childhood. They were, you know, competitive-ish here and there. I think 91 – they won like 88 games or something like that, you know, and it was an okay thing. Whitaker and Trammell and Tony Phillips are three guys that I really remember loving. Obviously, Whitaker and Trammell, who didn't love them, but Tony Phillips was great. Bobby Higginson was somebody that, you know, when they really turned to crap, he was known as their really good player, which speaks to the team really more than it does Higginson. He was a fine player, whatever, but he was not some sort of first division stud. So those teams in the late 80s, early 90s, they were bad, but I loved them. And the best, my best memories of them really are either Ernie Harwell on the radio or having them, the Tigers on TV on mute, and then my dad could pick up Tom Hamilton and the Cleveland Indians broadcast on the radio at night, and so we'd listen to Cleveland Indian games to hear who was on my mom and dad's fantasy teams while watching the Tigers. And those summer nights, those were just the best. I just became obsessed with the game, absorbing as much of it as I could in an age when you couldn't get that much. You know, you could usually only get your game or the superstations. Unfortunately, both superstations, TBS and WGN, were NL teams. And the National League in our house just didn't get as much run because they weren't fantasy relevant and there wasn't interleague play. So it was just kind of a different thing. So we really focused on the Tigers and any sort of American League baseball we could get on the radio.
Well, and that would have been – those superstations would have been the pre-good years for the Braves too. And the, I don't think the Cubs were anything special, you know, before Sammy Sosa either. So anyway, you had mentioned Tony Phillips. I suspect that news kind of hit you a little bit here in the last 2 days too.
Yeah, well, it was a bummer because I always liked Tony Phillips. You know, again, kind of growing up with him in that heyday. He played for the Tigers from 90 to about 94, 95. And again, one of their best players on teams that were pretty bad. It just seemed like a total, you know, baseball rat, as they say. The guy really seemed to love the game, but was also kind of a different player in that, a little bit more real than some of the other guys. You know, and obviously in today's game we get these guys who are a lot more polished and things like that. But this was a guy with flaws. Tony Phillips was, but he adored baseball, and the thing was he kept kind of playing as much as he could, and he even just a few years ago took like a 20 game stint down in an independent league down where my parents live. So my dad actually got to go check him out a bit at age 53 playing baseball, and then he played I think last year for a little bit at age 56, and then at age 56 now he's passed away, and that's crazy, and that's a total bummer. But I really, really like Phillips. Honestly, the easiest comp that he's been given is the right one. He was Ben Zobrist before Ben Zobrist was Ben Zobrist.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And you know, he was a sabermetric friendly player before sabermetrics were a thing. Lots of walks.
Was a generation ahead. You know, he comes in this age, and again, you know, we've seen it with Zobrist. He would have been valued so much more highly for Tony Phillips. But, you know, it was a great player. He really was a really fantastic player for a lot of years, did a lot of different things, and probably was never valued as properly as he should have been.
Now, you live in Austin, and yes. I've heard some great things about that as a kind of a cool city. But how did you settle there?
Well, I came to school. So my parents live in Harlingen, Texas, which is in deep South Texas. It's a smaller town, and that's just not really my vibe. Even though I grew up in a suburb, it's not like the city I grew up in outside of Detroit was all that big, but it had the access to Detroit. I mean, we could drive to Tiger games. I think it usually took about 20 minutes. It really wasn't that far. And so we had access to so much stuff. I went to a WWF event back when it was still WWF, by the way. Mm-hmm. That tells you how long ago it was. But, you know, tons of Red Wing games, obviously, Tiger games, Pistons games. All the big concerts obviously came through Detroit. So everything was there. And so even when we weren't living in the big city, still had plenty of big city feel because we were so close to it. Well, there's none of that in Harlingen. You know, some things would go to a city called McAllen, which was near there, but really the closest you get to anything was San Antonio, and that's 4 hours away. And I just wanted something with a little bit of a more lively vibe. So went to my visit at the University of Texas, instantly fell in love. Honestly, didn't even want to go back home for the 2 months before school actually started. And so once I went to school here, I just stayed. I just absolutely love this place. I think it's great. And it actually isn't really a big city itself either, certainly not on the scale of Detroit or even San Antonio itself, Houston, Dallas. It's definitely not like that, but it's a fake big city. It has some big city feel without actually being a big city, and I really like that about this place. I wish there was some pro sports here in Austin, but I'm okay. You know, being a diehard Longhorns fan, we've got AAA baseball in a city called Round Rock, which is just north of Austin. That's where the Texas Rangers farm system plays. So, you know, we got everything here. I really, really just like this place. It's got a great feel. And it's, you know, ever expanding as well. It's a great, great city.
What kind of things do you enjoy outside of the game? I know we talked and kind of bonded over hip hop in Phoenix and, I guess Scottsdale specifically. What other things do you like outside of baseball?
watch a lot of TV and movies. You know, I'm pretty diehard into baseball, like all winter and like just 12 months a year, really, to be honest. Play a lot of MLB The Show on my PlayStation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is heavy baseball. But as you mentioned, I listen to a lot of hip hop, both, you know, high quality and more pop hip hop, you know. Mm-hmm. So I kind of run the whole gamut there. But that's basically the only kind of music that I listen to, which maybe should broaden the focus a little bit more, but I don't really like anything else, so I'm fine with that. I'm obsessed with my dog. I had a beagle named Curtis. He unfortunately passed away in the summer. I was desperately obsessed with that dog. Got a new one, a wiener dog named Charlotte, a mini wiener dog, in fact, and I'm over the moon obsessed with her as well. So I spend a lot of time with my dog, taking walks, you know, things like that. Like I said, TV and movies. Geez, I'll just name a few shows. This doesn't run the gamut, but Broad City. Honestly, Comedy Central's doing a ton of great things, so I'll just give them a shout all told. Bob's Burgers is one of my favorites. I usually check out, you know, whatever flavor of the day is going on Netflix. I actually just watched that series, Love. Starts a little slow. It gets going. It's worth a watch, especially if you like any of the actors in it. I'll say that. But and I go to the movies all the time. We got this place called the Alamo Draft House here in Austin. Got five or six of them, and they've expanded out across the country as well. It's a thing. They're not all called Alamo Draft Houses across the country, but other cities have them too. It's just basically a theater where you can get some food and drinks as well. And it's a little bit of a higher – I don't want to say higher class because it makes it sound snooty. There's no, it's not special. It's just not as many scrubs go there. For whatever reason, because first off – okay, with the food, it's not necessarily inexpensive food. Even though it's not high-end, it is, you know, they're kind of charging you a little bit extra because they're bringing you food while you're watching your movie. So maybe that keeps some of the scrubs away. I just really like it. You get a great, solid mid-level meal while you're watching your movie. I'm obsessed with movies. I went and saw Deadpool last weekend. I thought it was really, really good. Big Short was the last movie I saw before that. Really liked it. So TV, movies, my dog, baseball, hip-hop, that's kind of my life. I keep it pretty simple.
That sounds pretty great. We got a theater out here that's got a bar and a restaurant in it, and then that you can bring the food in. They got the recliners in there.
Okay, yeah, so we got one of those too with the recliners.
Those are great.
What's it called?
Well, this is just St. Michael Cinema, the city I live in.
Okay, I wasn't sure if it's – because it's called like iPick or something here. I wasn't sure if that was a national chain or anything like that. We only have one of those with the recliners.
Well, what's amazing too is that – I live 25 minutes from downtown Minneapolis, but it's a small – it feels like a small town feel, and I grew up in a small town. So kind of get the best of both worlds. I can be to work in a half hour, but don't have to deal with traffic. You know, we went to the theater on a Sunday night, and we were the only ones in there. We saw Zoolander 2 just recently. It was horrible, absolutely awful. I don't know if you saw it.
Even if you loved Zoolander?
Yes, it was absolutely disgustingly bad. So don't let me keep you from watching it, but my wife loved Zoolander. We both were just shaking our heads. It was so bad.
See, my guess, and this is what this doesn't surprise me at all. I honestly, and I'm not saying that original Zoolander is on the same level as the movie I'm going to compare it to, but I have to imagine it's similar to the Dumb and Dumber
remake,
which everyone hated. Again, Zoolander original is not as high as Dumb and Dumber, but proportionally speaking, I think that fall off, I'm sure it's going to be similar. So I probably wasn't going to check out Zoolander 2 in the theater anyway. I'll wait till the DVD, just give it a run. You know, honestly, I felt the same way about Anchorman 2. I thought that really fell off and didn't live up to the second one either. So I don't know, maybe just stop doing that with the sequels. But of course, they're never going to do that because every once in a while it does hit. Hangover 2 actually wasn't too bad. It was compared to the first one, but 3, I think, is where they really lost it. So, you know, they're going to keep doing it with the remakes, and some will be all right, some will be total garbage. I'm not surprised that this one is utter trash.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cash grab. If your storyline doesn't really leave you anywhere to go, but you decide to keep forging on, you kind of get what you pay for. Honestly, yep. With Stiller and Wilson, they probably made enough money to justify it. But I think it's absolute trash.
That doesn't surprise me, unfortunately.
So you mentioned baseball specialty. I think it's pretty clear what your specialty is, but I kind of think you have two of them because I think fantasy you have to say two as well as your starting pitching thing. How did you come to the conclusion that those were going to be your two angles?
Well, I just, like I said, I got obsessed with fantasy pretty early, and I thought that was a field that I could maybe offer something on. You know, I really respect the guys who who write about kind of the game at large and how they come up with stories or things to tell. You know, Jeff Sullivan, you mentioned him earlier as his as the Loogie specialist. He's our colleague at Fangraphs, and I just really admire what he's able to do. But I couldn't do it. I don't think I could come up with two stories a day on the news of the day or those cool specialty ones that he comes up with, you know, looking at the 12 worst pitches or whatever of the year. Stuff like that, I love it. I absolutely love it. But I don't have that mind for that. I can kind of think of topics like that for fantasy. And so I really just focused on something that I thought that I was good at or at least wanted to be good at. So that was fantasy baseball. And then specifically pitching, you know, I mentioned the era that grew up in, the 90s and the 2000s. Well, pitching was a really tough thing to figure out then because it was so scarce and we were dealing with the juiced ball and the juiced player era. And so it was, you know, really tough to navigate. You could get a 4 ERA from somebody and be like, hey, that's my second starter. He's pretty dope. So, you know, I wanted to focus on kind of cracking that code. Obviously, it's different now where pitching kind of rules the game, which is fun, though. It's a lot of fun to kind of be at the be known as somebody who really loves to dive in on pitching when it is so fruitful right now. So, you know, again, just kind of decided that fantasy was a good focus for me because it was something I was playing a lot of and I thought I was getting better at. And then pitchers in particular, I don't really know what made me choose pitchers over hitters. I just kind of did one day. And actually, I'll tell you what happened. I used to be on this message board called RotoJunkie. .com. That's actually where I met Colette. This is back in the early 2000s, and this guy posted his top 100 pitchers for the upcoming season. And I didn't agree with quite a bit of it, so I posted my own response, just kind of did the same thing he did with a post of my top 100. He didn't love that, by the way. I guess he thought I was stealing his idea. I thought you just listed your top 100 pitchers or whatever. But so it became kind of an annual thing. I think for the first 3 years, I really just did it on a message board. Here are my top 100 pitchers with some reasoning as to why. And then it took off into making the starting pitcher guide, which is where it's at today.
Yeah, you were talking about Jeff Sullivan. I kind of think of myself when it comes to that as kind of like food. Like, I really like consuming the high-end stuff, but trying to turn around and produce it like a Keith Law might, like, I just can't do it. I can't read what he says about duck confit, or however he's probably confit. Saying it wrong. Confit. Yeah, there you go. See, that's how bad I am. I can't turn around and produce that, but I love consuming it and discussing it and, you know, engaging in that kind of thing. But then it turns around and like, there's got to be something easier to produce or something that's, you know, a little more
or just something that broad. Fits. That's the thing. It is easier for them probably to produce it. You speak of Keith Law specifically. Let's focus on his actual niche more than food, prospects. Yeah. I can't produce that same level. I for the starting pitcher guide, what I do is I read everybody's stuff. I check as many videos as I can on MILB.TV or YouTube, et cetera, and I, you know, I maybe catch 5 to 7 minor league games all year, but I also go to Arizona and check out the fall league. So I get a few looks here and there, but I'm no scout. So I don't have the expertise for the minors. I leave that to the guys who do have that. I kind of narrow my focus even more and really, really focus intensely on the major leagues. So, you know, you're talking about a different field with food. Even within baseball, I admire people who excel in fields that I don't consider myself great, and prospects is definitely one of them, particularly once you get kind of beyond double A. I've got a pretty good feel on a lot of triple A prospects. I feel confident talking about them, talking about their repertoire, what they're doing. But you start getting into some of the double A hidden guys and then even lower, high A, low A, I got to defer there because I just, first off, don't have the bandwidth for it, and they're just better at it. There are folks that can just look at a prospect for, you know, 3 hours on the backfields and get a decent feel. I couldn't do that. I got to read the reports, kind of know what I'm looking for, check the video, and even then I'm still deferring to the guys who are doing it best.
Yeah, I got a lot of respect for the guys that can do the things that I can't, and I try to be respectful to everybody, but deep down secretly, you know, those are the people that I respect the most in the game are the ones that can do things that either I haven't been able to do or I know, quite frankly, I'll never be able to do. One of those things that you do is the starting pitcher guide. How many years have you been doing that? This will be your number.
This will be the 9th year, I think. And wow. I don't think I'm counting all the ones that are on the message board. I think there were like maybe two others on the message board. So it might actually be the 10th year. But looking at my folder here right now, what I have that I can look back at, it's since 2008. So that's where we are right now, coming on to the 9th edition. It's been in a PDF, you know, quote unquote proper book form since I think 2011. So yeah, it's really expanded from a message board post to basically an extended blog post on pulsebore.com to a full-on PDF that people have, you know, paid for, which is amazing. And the first year I did it for like, I was like, okay, I'll put up some donations. You know, if people want to donate, cool. And people did, and I couldn't believe it. So I was like, okay, I'll keep doing it. And eventually I started selling it, and again, people wanted to do it. I'm like, this is the best. It's just really great. People support the work, and I'm happy to do it. It's a lot of fun to do.
Is it Doug Thorburn that you work with? Am I remembering that correctly?
It is Doug Thorburn, and he used to do the mechanics caps. This year it's a little bit different. He's not doing as many caps. He's doing a full-on, just like a more of a 3,000-word piece at the beginning that really kind of sets it up. The guide's going to be a lot different this year. It's going to be a lot more – first off, it's going to be more of a full year experience. There's going to be updates in season, something I've never done before. So the first version is going to be a little bit more distilled to kind of get folks into their drafts, give them a draft tool that they can use, because there's been so much information. I think last year it was like 150,000 words. Jeez. And who can really kind of – get into that before their draft, especially in this particular year, because with my other duties, I haven't been able to get it out as quickly as I wanted. Ideally, it would have been out like, you know, 2 weeks ago, give people some lead up to read it before their drafts, which are going to start coming up in March. Well, this year, it's going to be a lot more distilled. There's like these player boxes that you're going to read, along with a handful of really good articles at the front that kind of give you an idea of who I like this year, talk about prospects. I got some contributions from other folks outside of Doug. And then as the season goes on, it will get deeper, and that way it's a companion piece when players come up, or when you know, somebody gets traded to your favorite team, and you're like, oh, what do I know about this guy? Go back to the guide, look at it, things like that. So it's going to be more of a year-long thing than it's ever been. So I'm really happy about that, and that'll be available at the spguide.com soon. I wish I had a date. It's bad that I don't. I freely admit that. But between the Fangraphs, RotoWire work that I'm doing in the offseason, and this, I don't have the date yet, but I know it has to be like very soon, within like the next 10 days or so, because once we get into March, that's when things really start to go crazy for draft season, and it's got to be available for people's drafts.
All right, well, we're going to give away a copy to anybody who's been faithful enough to listen to this point of the show. All I want to know, the trivia question that we're going to request somebody at Midwest Swing Pod with the answer is, how many ground ball triples were hit in baseball last year? We discussed this off the air. First person to send an apt mention to Midwest Swing Pod with that number will win a copy of this SP guide. As soon as it comes out, I will make sure that it gets a PDF in the email of whoever wins. So
boom,
get those mentions in. So you mentioned going to Arizona Fall League. Are those trips for you? Are they business? Are they pleasure? Or are they a bit of both?
Well, they've turned into both. It's for the Baseball HQ First Pitch Forum. They put it at the same time that the Fall Stars game will happen. So they coincide. And, you know, it's basically a fantasy baseball conference where we kind of break down the last season, look ahead to next year, while also catching a bunch of games at the Arizona Fall League. And it's just the best. It's the absolute best. It's right in November, you know, kind of right after the World Series there. So you're already jonesing for a little bit more baseball, and you get this amazing weekend with a bunch of baseball diehards. And for a while, it was pleasure because I was just going to this conference and having a great time. Well, in the last 2 years, I've been invited to speak at the conference, which has now turned it into a little bit more of a business venture at that point, representing Fangraphs. So it's just amazing, though. It's one of the best weekends of the year for me. I absolutely love it. Wouldn't miss it for the world. I've been going now, I think, 7 or 8 years now. It's been a while, and so it's been a lot of fun. Baseball HQ puts it on. Ron Chandler and company, Brent Hershey, Ray Murphy, they do an amazing job with it. And I really recommend anybody that can get out there, do it, because you're really mixing the ability to go see baseball and watch guys with, you know, covering fantasy and deep diving into things, play poker at night. It's just a blast.
I think that I'm going to have to make a trip out there one of these years. I got an uncle that winters in Fountain Hills or something like that. So we'll see what we can do. Was I correct with my assessment? We saw you in the front row. Was it with Eno and Jason Collette that one game?
It was. We went with Eno on the field to start before the game to watch him, you know, kind of interview some guys. And I want to take that in. First off, that's another field that I don't have much experience in, you know, interviewing players. So I really wanted to go with him, kind of check that out. So we got a chance to do that. Since we were there so early, we went ahead and poached three prime seats sitting right behind the home plate there. And so we were on the game the whole time. It was great. It was just a total blast watching. You know, you don't get to see a lot of games from that angle. At least I don't. I don't have necessarily the money or really the desire to go do it a whole bunch. I love going to games. First off, it is great, but I also like being at home where I can have like three games on the TV, be on the computer, and really absorb the whole 15-game slate. I really do like both. So, yeah, it is nice to have that chance to really sit. I mean, we were in the first row. Like, those are the prime seats that everybody wants. And we had a blast. And I will say, I think there were three or four foul balls straight back. Didn't flinch on any of them. That's a
nice.
First.
That's,
that was the
that's
absolute
huge.
First for me.
That's professional status. You're not semi-pro if you're doing that.
That's what, and I was on TV. You know, I had to step up my game. I can't be flinching back there like a punk.
People would crumble under that sort of pressure, and you did a great job. I do want to switch gears. Since you are a Tigers guy, people want to believe that they're going to be better in 2016. Do you buy that they'll be better? Do you buy it on the surface?
Of course. I don't know how they couldn't be better. This is the last place finish last year that, you know, they realized that it wasn't going their way. Miggy gets hurt. No sense in keeping Price and Cespedes. I think that they handled last year brilliantly. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a Tigers fan. I've got no problem critiquing them when they deserve it. You know, but for those that are hearing me, they're like, this guy's a Tigers fan. He's just pumping his own team. No, but I don't know how you cannot objectively look at what they did last year and realize that it wasn't going anywhere. So they sold off the big pieces that they weren't going to keep to kind of retool for 2016. It was a really smart move. You don't see a lot of teams do that. And I thought that they handled it really well, especially when you then realize that Dave Dombrowski maybe knowingly was on his way out and still did a good one for the team, because all of a sudden, you know, in August, anyway, it wasn't even till the end of the year, he gets let go, and you're like, wow, minutes after he helps the team kind of get situated for 2016, he's moving on. And so, no, I think they did a great job really kind of getting some youth on the team. Everyone wants to make the comparison to Philly and say that they're going to age out the way Philly did. And I really don't see it that way, and I especially don't see it that way after last year, kind of getting some youth in there. They're not technically prospects, some of them, particularly Daniel Norris, because he has expired his rookie eligibility. But he's a prospect when you look at the team at large and you look at a 23-year-old who's only got like 65 major league innings. That's still a prospect. And the whole point was that the team was aging, and it's still an older roster, you know, probably compared to average. They're probably a little bit older, but I think it's overstated just how old that roster is. You look up and down the lineup, and yeah, they've got some old guys like Victor Martinez, but, you know, Miggy, I think, is 32 or 33. They do have actual young guys, too. James McCann, their catcher of the future. Nick Castellanos, the third baseman of the future. Jose Iglesias, their shortstop of the future. So they've got, you know, up the middle and left side of their infield, Anthony Gost and Cameron Maben out in center. So a lot of key components on their offense are actually younger. And if Daniel Norris and Michael Fulmer, the two big guys that they got back in those two deals for David Price and Yoenis Cespedes, if they pan out, now all of a sudden two-fifths of their future rotation is going to be really young. So I don't know. I think that they're doing their best to kind of keep the window open for this year. They very much want to compete, but they're still in a position where they can transition. If things break down, they can again start to look to maybe flip pieces. But I think they're going to be right in the thick of things this year. That AL is airtight. It's really tough to come up with bad teams in the AL. Even if you don't like some teams, I know Baltimore's getting some flack. I'm trying to think of other teams that I don't even know. Oakland.
Yep.
Those are two teams that are getting a lot of flack. But then you look at their roster, and I still would not be surprised. I'm not picking either of those teams to make the playoffs, but I wouldn't come away like, oh, my God, how did they make the playoffs the way we kind of looked at Houston last year and were surprised. I don't think that either of those teams would be that overwhelmingly surprising. Oakland is kind of that depth team where they're you know, solid everywhere, but they're not great anywhere. And then Baltimore has, you know, some really high powered offense and a good bullpen. If they could piece it together with the rotation, that's their way to compete. So the AL is just so tight. The AL Central is really tight. Obviously, you got the defending champs. You got that Cleveland Indians rotation on the rise. You've got the Minnesota Twins, who competed last year, have a lot of youth that they continue to develop. And even the White Sox, who were a chic pick last year, I think maybe people were just a year early on them. I'm not discounting them either. So it's going to be a tough road to hoe for the Tigers, but I think they have to be considered right up there in terms of the favorites to win. Maybe you handicap KC as the favorites. I would get that, but I can't imagine that folks have Detroit too much further than third and really close to second in that division.
Yeah, and the fun fact about Miguel Cabrera, he and Joe Mauer were born in the same month, and in fact, I believe one is like a week older than the other. So anytime you start thinking about one or the other getting old, you have to consider that the other
That's
one
really
is
really interesting.
Basically, yeah, April of 83, I believe, is the month they were born.
What a month.
So, yeah, crazy, right? And so my initial theory with the Tigers before I researched deep, so it's not a theory that I still hold. However, I believe it could become a popular theory in mainstream media fans is, okay, so you look at the team last year with Yoenis and Price. You look at the team this year with Zimmerman and Upton. If you could choose a player grouping, you would obviously take Yoenis and Price, I believe. Maybe you disagree.
Because Price is that really true ace, and yeah. I don't know that Upton is that so much better than the Cespedes to make up the difference. So, yeah, that's completely fair.
But foundationally, then, you think, well, gee, they weren't too good last year. What makes people think they're going to be better this year? What's your primary contention with that theory?
Well, keep in mind that Verlander didn't start pitching until June and kind of pissed away a month. You know, his first month back was a little bit rocky. It was super rocky, and then he got going. Anibal Sanchez was super hurt last year. So the rotation really broke down. And the real difference here, you know, you talked about the big ticket items. Well, the real difference between this Tigers team and actually the Tigers teams of previous ilks is the fact that they really addressed the bullpen, something that's been a problem for them for so many years. And it wasn't for necessarily a lack of effort. They just didn't get things to click. It's not like Dave Dombrowski. You know, I think he gets a bad rap, and I am defensive about that. I will take the homer call on that one maybe, because I do get defensive about it, because I think people acted like Dave Dombrowski just didn't try with the bullpen. He did. He tried to get those smaller pieces that would hopefully pop bigger. He tried with some of the bigger pieces. You know, there was no reason to believe that Joe Nathan was going to cliff dive. He'd been amazing for 2 years with Texas before that. The only thing that was working against Nathan was the age, and once you get to a certain age in baseball, you can drop off without warning. We kind of know that. So I think this year, though, they've done a full-scale rebuild of that bullpen. That's really the difference, even more so than Zimmerman and Upton. You're talking about K-Rod via trade comes in to close. But if he does Joe Nathan it and flips out or something like that, they got Mark Lowe and Justin Wilson, a righty and a lefty, two really strong setup men. Lowe was an injury reclamation that really got going last year with Toronto, got him via free agency. And then Justin Wilson, a really impressive lefty who was overshadowed in that Yankees bullpen for obvious reasons when you got Miller and Betances, but he was a big part of it as a lefty setup guy, Justin Wilson was, got him via trade. And so now you've got three brand new pieces who instantly become the three best pieces. You take a lot of that heat off of somebody like an Alex Wilson, who was forced into a back end role. There's still a chance that Bruce Rondon gets his stuff together. I know he was sent home basically for being, you know, a clown, like not trying hard enough, I think was basically the reason he was sent home, which is never a good thing, but he's young enough to kind of overcome that, and he still throws it 100. So I think that's really the biggest difference here. The offense was actually still pretty good for a lot of last year outside of when Miggy was hurt, but also Victor Martinez, if he can stay healthy, that could be a big piece. Growth from Castellanos and McCann, it could be a big piece. The Cameron Maben, Anthony Gose platoon in center field could be pretty good. It should definitely be good defensively. But even if it could be league average with the bat, then all of a sudden that's a quality spot that they're getting. So I think really the bullpen and getting some health is why they're different from last year. Health was a big piece, but also the bullpen was so unbelievably bad, it wasn't even funny last year. And then the rotation really started to melt down too, because they lost any depth that they had. Obviously, they traded Price. I mentioned that Verlander was out for a while, but Sanchez didn't really pitch at all. So Also, that big piece, Daniel Norris, that we mentioned, they're expecting not everything out of him. He doesn't have to go out and give 200 innings, but they're expecting probably 150 solid innings from him. The rotation and the bullpen are going to be the keys as to why it's a different team this year than the last place finish from last year.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that I was thinking too, there's certain layers that I've kind of, as I've studied it, it has evolved. You know, you're thinking, man, Miguel Cabrera is a year older, Victor Martinez is a year older, Justin Verlander is a year older. But at the same time, you do have to also keep in mind it was a team that was pretty much in the thick of it until Cabrera got hurt. And in fact, I think I tweeted you, do you think they'll sell off with Cabrera hurt? And I think you had expressed some skepticism at that point, and then it got worse. And it got to the point where it actually made sense for them to sell off, and they did. But
exactly.
I think there's enough pieces that can be moved around where you can see the optimism, especially in a topsy-turvy American League where literally, there are probably 15 teams in contention. So my initial theory, I think, is a little bit misplaced. But at the same time, you know, you're going to have to view every team in the American League kind of with a little bit of side eye, because every team has one flaw where you're like, yep, that could sink them. That could be their fatal flaw. But if they overcome that, they're going to be in the thick of things.
Oh, I absolutely think that, like you said, there's no perfect team out there. If they're in the NL Central, it's a totally different story.
Right.
You know, they're probably lucky to get third out in that division right now. It's really stacked, a really top-heavy National League right now. Interesting place to be for that league. But in the American League, like I said, it is wide open. And I do think that this is a team with the Tigers that they have all the pieces to compete, and they can get reinforcements in season. You know, Michael Fulmer was a piece that they got in that Cespedes deal I mentioned. Shane Green is somebody I was really high on coming into last year, and everyone looks at his bottom line last year and thinks, oh, you know, that was garbage. He totally fell apart. Remember the hot start that he got off to and then just completely fell off the map? Well, for some reason, since people didn't really know who Shane Green was, they just assumed, well, he was playing over his head. He must suck. Actually turned out to be a hand aneurysm, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I read about that.
Could not feel his fingers. So I think that that's actually a pretty decent excuse for a 6.88 ERA. And he tried to gut through it, you know, didn't really even let them know for a little while, just say, you know, I got to go out there and pitch it. And that is kind of a curse of athletes. A lot of them will do that. And we know that that's not the best. But, you know, I think there's a very clear reason why he sucked so hard after getting off to a good start, and there's a reasonable expectation for him to be better as well. So I think it's a deeper and better team than it was last year with the pieces that they got, both via trades and free agency, and that's why I think they'll contend. Because also, what you make a great point. Early on, they were in it. It's not like they were last from the jump. They basically tanked after, you know, Miguel got hurt, and then they traded their two other superstars and just said, you know what, it's a lost season. Let's get out of here. But they were 15-8 in April, closer to 500 in May, and then June, July, August, September is when it fell apart.
Now, quickly before we move on to a couple of small things before we're done here, what is your expectation out of Daniel Norris this year? Obviously, getting a piece like that for a rental like David Price is a huge boost for Detroit. Do you have huge expectations for him, especially coming off, you know, a very tumultuous offseason?
I mean, I've got some expectations for him. I'm not going to say that, you know, he's got to come and, like I said, be some 200-inning stud right away. I just don't think that that's fair or accurate for Norris. He's still a young guy who doesn't have a ton of MLB experience. We're looking at a 23-year-old with 67 innings of MLB work. But he's shown some things, even last year. You know, he broke camp with Toronto, didn't look great in five starts, you know, it was kind of up and down, but didn't look awful either. I think I don't even think he necessarily had to be sent down. It wasn't one of those, like, we got to get you sent down for your own good because you're just getting your face caved in. I think that, you know, Toronto was competing. They just wanted to situate themselves to where they had a little bit more stability at the back end of the rotation. So they sent him down. Obviously, then he was traded to the Tigers, came up, showed some good things with them too, was kind of up and down. Actually had that 54-pitch first inning, which was kind of bananas that Al Smith allowed him to do that. But for the most part, there was that start and one other bad one against Boston. But otherwise, he was pretty good with them. So he's shown some things to where they can have a reasonable expectation of, like I said, you know, 150 to 170 innings of quality work. You know, he had a 3.75 ERA last year with a 1.20 whip. If he was able to do that over, you know, 30 something starts, that would be perfectly fine for them at the back end of their rotation. But the beauty of it is the fact that he could do more. You know, they could settle for that while they have Zimmerman and Verlander fronting the rotation, but he could emerge as well, and Daniel Norris could all of a sudden be, you know, a number three caliber starter if he took a couple steps this year.
Yeah, good stuff on Norris there. Let's blend your two niches. Let's talk fantasy pitchers. Who are your sleeper starters this year? I don't want you to necessarily give in, you know, give out some of your secrets so your draft mates can steal them, but who are some of the guys you're keeping an eye on as you head into drafts this year?
Well, you mentioned Iglesias, who, again, is not really a great one anymore because the price is really on the rise, but he is a total has total stud potential. I'll start kind of work my way down because there are different values, you know, at different parts of the draft. I think that at the high end, somebody that's, you know, again, not a sleeper. Everyone knows him, so we're talking differently here when we're using that term. But value from maybe where they're being drafted, I really like Garrett Richards. I think he's somebody who could be a top 20 starter, and he's going in NFBC drafts as the 29th starter off the board. So that's a nice little value surplus there as far as I'm concerned.
I've got him in Ottawa, so I'm looking forward to that.
Really, really like his stuff is just so filthy. I'm willing to bet on the stuff for sure. We saw the greatness in 2014, and we saw some pretty good stuff last year. Let's not suggest that he was no good just because he didn't match his 2014. I still thought he was pretty good coming off that knee injury and pitched the whole season. So I like Garrett Richards. Jumping down another level, I like Carlos Rodon. I think he can take a step forward again, betting on stuff. I understand that his command isn't very good right now, and he does need to work on that. That's something that we're kind of hoping takes a step forward with you're betting on him, but I think it can. And that's a guy who, you know, looks like a fourth, fifth starter right now, who could definitely become that closer to a frontline type if you know, one or two things click with his command. So I really like Carlos Rodon as well. Jumping down yet again, I like Wei-Yin Chen. I think he made a really great move, one of the best moves that you can make going from the AL Beast to the NL East, and his park from Baltimore to Miami.
He's a fly ball guy, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a fly ball guy who survived in Baltimore, by the way. Let's be honest, you know. Exactly. Well, because he's good, because he can actually induce weak contact. And, you know, he could, when he would get out of a park that wasn't home run favorable, when he wasn't giving up home runs, he was especially good. But even with the home run rate that Chen had at 1.2 homers per nine, he still posted a 3.72 ERA in Baltimore, bringing it down each of the last 3 years from 4.07 to 3.54 to 3.34 last year. And I really believe that he can do a lot of what he did last year for another full season, but also kind of have the skills to back it up. Last year, his 3.34 ERA came with a 4.16 FIP, so people think that Chen's going to fall off. But I think the new setting, the new league, and the new park are really going to work in his favor. He could get a little bit, a few extra strikeouts. Not great. You know, he's 7.2 last year. I'm not saying he's going to get up to 9 or 10, but maybe 8.5 strikeouts per nine. Just the extra trickle from facing the pitcher and getting into some better two-out situations when you're facing that pitcher, get some extra strikeouts. I just think there's going to be a lot of good for somebody like Wei-Yin Chen this year. So I really do like him. And then I like Jose Berrios. Really thought he should have been called up last year.
Oh, yeah.
I'm definitely willing to gamble on him. Matt Moore. It's kind of a post-type guy. You know, everyone was really geeked on him several years ago. It did not work out. Then injuries struck, and now he's kind of a forgotten guy. You're going to look at his bottom line last year and be like, he was terrible. But if you kind of look at his last handful of games in AAA and the majors last year, maybe his last 10 starts total or whatever, he's pretty good and really started to show some of those things that we got excited for him for so many years ago. So I do like Matt Moore again as a post-type. And then kind of getting much deeper, I love Vincent Velasquez, and I think kind of moving to Philly is a great move for him because it's going to open up opportunity where it might not have been available in Houston. Houston is now in a contending position. They can't necessarily afford to kind of go through any bumps with him, which there could be some, but he's got killer stuff. Again, I'm talking a lot about guys who have killer stuff. Bet on stuff, even if the command isn't quite there yet, because that's something that can come. I like guys who can command stuff, even if their stuff isn't great. But I'm willing on young guys. I want to bet on that premium stuff that could really, you know, a couple clicks of the command away from turning into a super stud. So I really like Vincent Velasquez out there in Philly. And then one more, another kind of hometown guy for you guys, Kyle Gibson, I think is somebody who could take another jump forward. I don't think he gets enough credit for kind of the year that he had last year because it wasn't, you know, some fantasy studly season. I think that is one thing where fantasy can hurt is that we judge guys too much on how fantasy relevant it was, and you know, we're not willing to give enough credit when something was just a really good season, even if it wasn't fantasy relevant. And I think that's where Gibson is. It was a good season in fantasy, you know, it was useful in like a deep mixed league or like an AL only for sure, but it wasn't overwhelming. And yet I think there is still another step for Kyle Gibson. He was somebody I really liked when he was a prospect, and I still like him now.
Yeah, that was a guy who I accidentally won a bid for Josh Hamilton for a buck in Audinu over the weekend, cut him and picked up Gibson for $4. And for Gibson, if you look at after April, I think he only struck out something like four batters in the entire month of April. After that, he had like a 7.3 or something like that, strikeouts per nine. When you add to that 50%+ ground balls, you've already got kind of like a Dallas Keuchel starter kit. Again, not to that level. Don't get me wrong. He's not going to replicate that and be a Cy Young candidate. But you start to see the wheels moving in a positive direction. He needs to do one of two things. Now, he was also one of the two guys I was going to mention for my sleepers. He needs to do one of two things. He needs to either tighten up the command a little bit. And I don't know if it's necessarily the walks as a factor of him nibbling or as a factor of him losing his release point. Or, you know, he needs to find a way to either calm that down or limit home runs to an extreme. He gives up too many home runs for such a strong ground ball guy. But if
exactly.
he can do one,
so it's like when he misses,
yep,
it's a bad miss.
Well, I think it's a sinker left up. You know, it's going to flatten out and it's going to get pummeled. So I think there's room for him. I believe he should be the Twins opening day starter for what it's worth too. I don't know that matters a whole lot. But anyway, he's one of my guys where, again, at $4, I think he's going to be a nice auto new deal. And then I don't know if you would consider this guy a sleeper, but he's coming back from an injury. I got him in Audinu as well. Zach Wheeler is a guy that I absolutely love. He's got the strikeouts and grounders. He's playing for the Mets, so he's going to have to scratch and claw for his way into the rotation. But I believe what they're planning on doing is kind of a tandem system with him and Bartolo Colon in the fifth spot. And it's just going to be, you know, give Wheeler whatever he can handle. Bartolo can pick up the slack. Is that a guy you like too?
I love Zach Wheeler. I'm not huge on Tommy John returners, though, so
sure.
I will probably have at least one share of him as a kind of a just-in-case situation. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, TJ returners, their first year back, I kind of let him go. But he's somebody I definitely like in keeper leagues.
And that's the case
and
here,
situations,
yeah.
Yeah, where you can see beyond this year for Wheeler, that's where I do really like him because I do think that this is a guy who, you know, keep in mind, and obviously I don't think he's necessarily going to be this way anymore, but coming up, a lot of folks thought he would be better than Harvey. And I will toot my own horn and say I was not one of those because I really loved Matt Harvey coming up. And that was,
right.
You know, obviously one that I got right. But it doesn't mean Zach Wheeler's bad. Zach Wheeler's really good, and you know Tommy John slowed him down, but a lot of strikeout potential. He can really fall in line with that excellent staff and not miss a beat. Especially, I mean, the scary thing is that next year he could be like their fifth starter, which is just dirty. Like, that's not fair that Zach Wheeler could be your fourth or fifth starter.
Who are you avoiding at all costs?
At all costs, obviously it's tough to say that because I'm, you know, there could be a, you know,
sure.
some guy can fall way down. I get it. But, you know, Yu Darvish, I mentioned Tommy John returners. I think he's being way overpriced in the market. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of, like, I get it. And I love Yu Darvish. It's really tough. And it's one of the toughest things in fantasy is to kind of divorce yourself from the guys that you do like if their price isn't right in the market. You know, Sonny Gray's a guy I continue to battle with that from. The last 2 years now, I've kind of been out in the market as down on Sonny Gray, yet at the same time, I love Sonny Gray as a pitcher. I love watching him pitch. I think he's a really good pitcher.
I got Brendan Rodgers for him in score sheet because I couldn't keep him. So
ooh,
it worked out.
That's a nice flip. Hey, I obviously he's not going to come up this year, but his path could be accelerated with the situation going on with Reyes out there.
Yep.
It's, you know, they probably want to rid themselves of him. And these allegations, if they're true, I mean, garbage. Can't deal with that. Can't have that. And he needs to be punished commensurate with whatever he did. So hopefully MLB figures that out. But Trevor Story is probably the prime beneficiary from that to bring it back to baseball. But Brandon Rodgers could be up quickly. I think that's a pretty good trade. I just think that Sonny Gray, you know, gets valued as a top 20 starter. He doesn't have the strikeouts to do that, so he needs those elite ratios, and I don't know that I feel confident that he's always going to get those. Right. I look at his fielding independent numbers, and they say, you know, like a 3.3, 3.4 kind of ERA. Well, he's down below the 3 last year and maintaining stuff like that. I understand that he does induce a lot of weak contact with that amazing stuff and a great ground ball rate that will help him maybe beat those fielding independent numbers. But for me, for a top 20 stud, I need somebody who can get the strikeouts a little bit more, and he just doesn't deliver at that level for me. So that's why I generally avoid Sonny Gray.
So I don't want to call anybody must get, but who do you have hard eyes over for pitchers in these drafts coming up here?
Well, I mentioned Richards is one, and it's because I like that price. It's tough to have that too much about guys on the upper end, because you just don't know if you're going to get a chance at them or if you want to take them, you know, in that first or second round. So, you know, I like some of those elite studs. I still love Corey Kluber. I love Thor, Noah Syndergaard, Carlos Carrasco. I like those guys, but we'll see if the draft gives them to me. Once you start to kind of get more in the fifth, sixth round and beyond, it's a little bit different. So again, I mentioned Richards, somebody that I love. Verlander, still somebody I'm going to the mat with, because the price is still down. I still think there's a lot of people who are not believing in what he did last year. And I think the key was the high fastball. And so as long as he's still pumping that high fastball up there, even if it's not at the same velocity, he can utilize what's called effective velocity, where essentially it looks faster than it is. And that high fastball, particularly up and in, is where you get the most effective velocity. So you can make 92, 93 look like that 95, 96. Plus, let's be honest, he still has that in his back pocket. It's not like Verlander never gets up to mid upper 90s anymore. It's just that he's not necessarily doing it in the eighth inning with consistency the way he used to. But I always thought Verlander was going to age really well because he has a deep secondary arsenal. So I was kind of surprised when he struggled for those couple years, but I think it's very clearly injury related. He had a core surgery before 2014, and I think that too often in fantasy we make the mistake of thinking, well, if they're pitching or playing, they must be healthy. And that's just simply not the case. And I think it was pretty clear that Verlander was very much less than 100% throughout that 2014 season, due likely to that core surgery, which affected his mechanics. And then last year he had the bicep strain that cost him the first couple months of the season, and he was battling back from that to start. And then once he was healthy, he was a total stud.
I think what separates the men from the boys, and you can tell me if this theory holds water with you, is when you have – if you line up all the fireballers, the young Felix, the young Lincecum, the young Verlander, what changes separates the men from the boys is basically like the age 28 to 30 seasons, when the fire starts to go away from their fastball. You find out if they can pitch, and there are guys whose star completely fades out. Lincecum might be that kind of guy. Again, injuries are part of it, but I don't believe even a healthy Tim Lincecum would still throw 95. I don't believe
exactly.
A healthy Felix right now would not throw 95, or Felix does not throw 95 anymore. But there are the guys who have the heat but have the other stuff, and they learn to pitch and go through it and become a guy like a – I don't know that Tim Hudson was ever a fireballer, but a guy who can pitch into their late 30s. I think that's what separates the men from the boys when it comes to fireballers.
I completely agree with that. And you know, because that velocity is going to fade. Time is undefeated in that realm. So you're going to lose that velocity eventually, and you're going to need to be able to do something without it. And that's why I always thought that Verlander would be a stud, was because he had such a deep secondary arsenal, great changeup, ridiculous curveball, filthy slider, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Felix obviously has a great deep arsenal as well, and that's why he's been able to maintain. By the way, I think his demise, you know, it's greatly overstated. I think he's still going to be a stud this year. I'm not running away from him at all. But you're definitely right. You know, as you get older and that velocity starts to wane, what have you got? What are your secondary pitches like? What can you actually do? And I think that's a big key right now. And we are seeing some of the previous generation of studs get into their 30s, and we're seeing the ones that hold up and the ones that fall off. And it really does come down to pitching, but also injuries. That is a big part of it as well. We have to be honest about that. But secondary arsenal and the ability to quote unquote pitch is a big key as well.
Yeah, the guys I have hard eyes for, and this will be me reading off my auto new list because I'm pretty strict about how I go after. I got a $22 Garrett Cole, a $13 Danny Salazar. I did spring for a $12 Zach Wheeler. That's a long term play.
Yeah, obviously.
$8 Andrew Heaney, $8 on Lucas Giolito, I think can still be okay. $7 Garrett Richards, $6 Shelby Miller, $4 Kyle Gibson, $4 Julio Urias, $3 Alex Wood, and then I got $3 a piece on Trevor May, Phil Hughes, Tyler Duffy, and Jose Barrios. So there's some potential there, not as much high end. Garrett Cole for $22 is huge, though.
I like how you loaded up on the home team there. Well, one of those will definitely pop well for you, I bet. Yeah, at least one.
And if they fail, you cut them and you move on.
You move on.
One small thing I want to get into, and then we'll do a lightning round and get you out of here. MLB The Show is obviously a big part of your life. It's a big part of mine, too. A friend just tweeted me while we were on the air here that they are going to incorporate wins above replacement this year.
What
are you most excited about this year's game? Obviously, this last year's game was so incredible that I have literally played only an hour of Madden 2016. I've literally only played an hour of that game since it came out because I can't take MLB The Show out of my PS4.
I can't either. Well, I didn't get the disc. I actually got the digital version. But
so you literally can't take it out either.
Literally can't, but I wouldn't anyway. The game is so amazing. I feel like sometimes people probably think I'm a shill for it, like I'm getting some money on the back end from them. I'm not. I just adore the game so much. I can't even begin to tell y'all. It's just such a good game. It's unbelievable. In terms of what I'm really looking forward to this year was last year they had this thing called Diamond Dynasty. Apparently they've had it for a few years. Here's the thing. Let me tell you this too. I'm new to the game at large because I was an Xbox person, mm-hmm. which was – I didn't know. Listen, if I'd known – that this game called MLB The Show was only available on PlayStation. I'd have gotten a PlayStation 1 a long time ago and jumped on that train. But for whatever reason, I was on the Xbox train and was missing out on baseball, really. In fact, for the last couple years, they haven't even had a baseball game, let alone the inferior ones that they used to have. With
2K was trash.
Yeah, garbage. It just wasn't good. So that was kind of the situation I was dealing with. So PS4 comes out. Okay, I'm going to make the switch over, get MLB The Show. Oh, my God, it's even better than people have said. Mm-hmm. So great. Diamond Dynasty was a thing that they had where you kind of build your fantasy team, so to speak, and play against everyone else, you know, kind of that ladder thing where you kind of work your way up the ladder. But apparently it used to suck. It just used to be garbage. It used to be fictional players or something. I don't even know. It just wasn't good. People didn't like it. Well, this year they changed it. They kind of followed the lead of Madden, which has something called Madden Ultimate Team, MUT, where you build the team and you collect these cards and those are the players, et cetera, et cetera. They followed that lead, and it was so much fun. The problem was you couldn't play your friends. So I had this really dope team, and I could never – you know, I couldn't just say, Brandon, what's your Diamond Dynasty team looking like? Let's fire up a couple teams and play. Mm-hmm. Well, they got it this year. You can finally play Diamond Dynasty against your friends. You know, it doesn't count for the ladder, so you can't manipulate it to kind of like work your way up the standings by beating your friend 10 times in a row. But that's fine. I don't care. I just want to be able to take my Diamond Dynasty team – especially in the early stages when you're still building it. By the time you reached August last year, everyone had a lot of the studs if you were playing it with any regularity, which is fine. I mean, that's, you know, you're building up over the season. You're going to have the Harpers and the Kershaws or whatever. It came to a point last year where I was just using other guys just to have fun with them because everyone was using the same exact stud players. But this year I'm just really excited about the fact, first off, there's tons of things that are new, but the one to pinpoint is that you can finally Diamond Dynasty against your buds.
That's fantastic. How about this? Quick lightning round and we'll get you out of here. What do you think?
Sure.
All right. First question, Dexter Fowler signing with Baltimore. Your thoughts?
Great. It's a solid move. I really like it. That's where they should be allocating their resources. I really hope for their sake that this Yovani Gallardo deal falls through because I thought it was a bad deal. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a bad allocation of resources. It's less about Gallardo himself and more about what he costs with the pick and what he offers them. I just don't think he offers them enough to be worth that first round pick. So obviously if that deal falls by the wayside, well then Fowler costs the first round pick. And I think you can make a much better case for him being worth it. And then they can go out elsewhere and maybe figure out kind of that mid-tier pitcher.
Yep, I thought Fowler at the top of that order. It's an order that's going to score some runs, but an on-base guy at the top in front of Machado, in front of Chris Davis, makes a ton of sense.
I think it's, yeah, that's been a constant in his game. Even if he doesn't kind of bring that same power that we saw last year, which was a little, you know, a little bit new, even without that, I still think we're talking about a total on-base stud that's really going to set up the lineup nicely.
Do you think that the Gallardo situation is going to fall apart?
I mean, they're pretty stringent on their physicals, so I feel like, yeah, it probably is. Unless they can restructure to a level that they like, because I think that's what they're trying to do now. Is you know, can we get this down to a number that we're comfortable with?
Well, is this because they're bidding against no one, so they're trying to nickel and dime them at the bargaining table?
You know what I think they do? I don't even think it's a strict physical. I think what they do is they make these deals that are pending physical to test the reaction. And when the reaction is utterly horrible, they're like, wait, we got to figure out a way out of this. I'm mostly joking about that, but maybe not, because they did not really get any love on this particular deal.
Right. Now, if people feel like I'm asking you a lot about the Orioles, it's because we've been working together on some stuff at Baltimore Sports and Life. You can find them on Twitter. I don't remember their exact handle, but so if it seems like we're a little Orioles heavy in this lightning round, it's for that reason. Orioles as a team, your thoughts? Because I ask because basically all the projections have them pegged as the worst team in the American League. That's not really saying much because, you know, it's so topsy turvy. But do you think they've got a chance to be sneaky good?
Yeah, they do have a chance to be sneaking good. Like I said, I understand why they're down there, and you know, it makes total sense just looking at it. But at the same time, being down at the bottom, like we said, in the American League is not a death sentence necessarily. They can definitely work out of that. But when you're looking at it on paper, it totally makes sense because we don't know what's really going to happen with the rotation, and that's the key. However, I really do like that bullpen, as I mentioned, and mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of – listen – KC is getting a bunch of hate again with the prediction systems because their rotation isn't that good. And people are like, oh, you know, they're all over them again. Pakota doesn't like them, et cetera, et cetera. And it's because of that rotation. I get it. But they only need 5 or 6 innings out of guys, and then they go to their bullpen. And I think that Baltimore has a pretty dang good bullpen. They've got total studs at the back end. Britton and O'Day is as good a 1-2 punch as you'll find, which is saying something in a division that has the Yankees and the Red Sox, where they've got some amazing 1-2 punches themselves. And I think that Baltimore can definitely compete when you're talking about Britton and O'Day, not to mention some of their other back end guys. But, you know, they need something big from Gausman. He's really, really got to step up finally if they're going to compete. I think that has to be a piece. And they can't really have anybody in the rotation melt down and you know, be some 5 ERA. Like, Ubaldo cannot go out there and do, you know, a 5-10 ERA for 125 innings. I just think that'd be too much to overcome. But otherwise, I really think that, yeah, that when you're stack ranking all the teams 1 to 14 in the American League, they're closer to the bottom. I totally get that. But again, just not a death sentence this year.
We've both written at length on Kevin Gausman. Find Paul's diagnosis on Kevin Gausman's player page on Fangraphs. You can find mine at Baltimore Sports and Life as of last night. I think we both fall pretty similar on the side of him, but he's kind of their only guy with ace potential. Anyway, moving on. Where do you see Ian Desmond landing?
The Rockies are looking more and more likely, especially, you know, we talked about the situation with Jose Reyes being a piece of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if that is as bad as it certainly looks on the surface, and he ends up having to serve some substantial time of a suspension, then that they probably don't want Trevor Story to be the guy right mm-hmm. away, because that's a lot of pressure. They probably like to work him in a little bit more. So, you know, they've been talking about signing Desmond, and I think sneakily Desmond could end up being an outfielder if, you know, say Trevor Story did prove ready by the middle of the season or something. Maybe they talk with Desmond and say, listen, we're going to bring you in. You're going to be the shortstop to start for sure, but we're thinking maybe you go to the outfield after a while, because he didn't have a great defensive year last year. He's never really been an amazing defender. And it's not, you know, a lot of it is errors, but it's also just at times I think his throwing is a little bit off too. And I think that he could definitely be even a center fielder, but definitely a corner outfielder. And they need guys with some good speed and capability to track down. That's the thing that goes unnoticed, I think, by a lot of people with regards to Coors Field. They just think home runs, home runs, home runs. It's the outfield that allows so many hits because it's so spacious, because they tried to curb the home runs. That's what makes it such a tough park. And I think that, you know, you get an outfielder out there with somebody like the athleticism of Desmond, that would totally work. So I think if they want to get him on board as a potential outfielder for part of the contract, that would be a really good move for them. Covers the shortstop gap right away and then transitions them into a situation where he can be an outfielder.
Now, the complicating fact, of course, is the crowded outfield there, where they do have a lot of money into Parra, Blackman, and Gonzalez, but Gonzalez gets hurt. You know what might have made...
Well, Gonzalez, you know, probably someone they're still looking to trade, though, too.
True.
And it would probably be more of a 2017 and beyond thing. I could definitely see Desmond staying at short all year with the plan for 2017, maybe, to be an outfield situation. Because you're right. They traded Dickerson because they already had four guys. They're probably not going to go sign Desmond with the explicit purpose of being an outfielder this year.
Now, what would have made more sense to me was Jimmy Rollins signing a minor league deal there and the White Sox signing Desmond, you know, a team that desperately needs a shortstop, and especially a one-year stopgap for Tim Anderson if that's the kind of deals that Desmond's looking at right now. But at the same time, if I wasn't going to go with the Rockies, the White Sox, you know, if they want to make Rollins a utility guy maybe, then you're still looking at a decent fit there if they have the money or if they're willing to spend the money. And that would be kind of my number two team there. All right, final question before we let you go. What's your read on this Jose Bautista contract situation?
I'm fine with everything that he's saying. You know, he's right. They did get a pretty good discount on him for all these years leading up to now. And this is his last bite. So I've got no problem with it. You know, I think some people kind of get bothered because he's got that kind of sassy tone or whatever. You know, he seemed like almost like he's angry, but that's kind of the way he talks. There's just some people that kind of talk like that. Well, I've had friends in the past where it always seems like they're like a little bit ticked. And it can be uncomfortable or whatever, but I think people are reading a little bit too much into it, thinking that, you know, he's like pissed off at Toronto. I don't think that. He's just saying, listen, this is what it is. You know, they got plenty of surplus value off of me these last few years. I don't think he's mad about it or anything. He understands that he's a late career bloomer, but now is his last chance to get a bite. He's probably not going to get $5,150 because that seems like a lot to pay somebody who's going into their age 35 season. But he deserves a big contract, so I'm totally cool with him saying, listen, I got to get paid, and this is the number. I'll definitely stay in Toronto, but if they're not going to pay it, I'm going to look elsewhere.
I don't really blame him either. I see both sides as being
in their
right spot, you know, in the right mind on both sides.
I think the idea of a hometown discount is bullshit, really. And ooh. I don't understand how they turned around. Owners pulled off a miraculous trick by turning around and making that a thing to where if the player doesn't give one, they're seen as the villain.
Right.
Why? That's like the bank asking us to give them some sort of reprieve. Yeah. I don't understand that. Teams that, you know, they pretend that they're poor or that they need a break or anything like that. Shut up, man.
It's horrible.
Baseball is as healthy as this can be. Toronto is definitely on the upswing there, in particular with what they're doing. There's money. They've got the money. If you don't want to spend it, just say you don't want to spend it. But don't act like Bautista is the one who owes anybody anything with some sort of hometown discount. Again, if you're just looking, I don't like to necessarily just do the dollars per war thing. I think that's definitely fraught with potential downside there to do that as a calculation. But if you just want to look at what he's done last year, the last several years compared to what he's made, then they're going to owe him a heck of a lot of money because he's given them so much surplus value that I don't think that we need to be asking him to kind of come down on his number. I'm completely fine being on the player's side with this.
Well, Paul, we went way into overtime. I want to thank you for joining us. We're definitely going to have you again here very soon, but thank you. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me on.
So for producer Andy Carlson, for special guest Paul Spohr, this is Brandon Warren signing off for Midwest Swing. Join us next week as Michael Bauman, formerly of Grantland, or of the former Grantland, joins us. We'll have another spirited baseball discussion. You can find us on iTunes and look for Midwest Swing on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey there, it's Sam Ekstrom, and I'm here to tell you that I'm not perfect. I have vices. Most of us do. Maybe you're like Peyton Manning and you enjoy Budweiser. Maybe you can't resist Dairy Queen blizzards. Maybe you're into e-cigs. Hey, no judgment. I enjoy betting on sports. And if you also enjoy betting on sports for a little entertainment, you'll love the podcast featuring yours truly, Sam Ekstrom, along with Sam Verhulst, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Available on iTunes and on Stitcher. Don't dread the spread. Turn your nickels into dimes.
The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.